there is like a split, you know, between the people. It's polarized. But then during the protests, somehow people found each other, and they came together.
There were both kinds of people.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. And that was really miraculous.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
What would you say that, I know that, you know, rural life is quite probably quite different than Tehran and the big cities.
Mm-hmm. It's much quieter.
Yeah,
Tehran
so
there's
not,
huge.
not as much of a protest happening out in the rural areas, or is there still
well,
some?
Well, in the villages, I don't know. Obviously, they're not as populated as the big cities, but I know that the big cities, where the majority of the population is, there have been unrest, such as Kermanshah, mm-hmm. Tabriz, and Shiraz, and many other places.
It's
Ilam.
Been pretty widespread.
Yeah, it's pretty widespread. It's just not Tehran. And Tehran, obviously, is the one with the biggest population, and people have been getting news out of there, and the journalists were covering it there. The journalists were not allowed to travel outside of Tehran. So that's one of the reasons why initially we were not getting news.
That's foreign journalists or just all
foreign journalists? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so you said there isn't really freedom of the press, so there isn't like opposition media that...
There is, there are bloggers, there are quite a few newspapers, and what they do is they close down newspapers when
they do the wrong thing.
When they do the wrong thing. And yeah. Then, of course, the newspapers, they get arrested, they get thrown in jail, they come back, they open it up again. And so this is not new. This mm-hmm. has been happening for years. So it's a constant fight. And a lot of people, what they do is they get satellite TV. They have illegal satellites, and so, you know, they can get international news. But the state-run TV is controlled by the Ayatollah.
Mm-hmm.
He appointed the head of the state media. So,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, well,
and that's it for this particular show. Which, unfortunately, we aren't able to conclude. There's another 20 minutes left in the show, but whoever's putting on these shows has to do a better job of figuring out when the regular programmers come on, because I'm a regular programmer, and unfortunately, though I'm very interested in this subject, it's not one I want to devote a fifth of my show time to. So if you're interested in this show, you listeners who have heard the part of it that you've heard, and that was most of it, actually, give a call to the free radio voicemail, 427-4523, and register your request that the show be repeated again at another time, and to let people know when that time will be. Leave your phone number again, 427-4523, if you'd like to hear the remainder of that show. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. My name is Robert Norris. The show you're going to be listening to now is my Thursday edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And we're going to be talking about stuff on the streets and what's happening in Santa Cruz. So stay with us.
We will rally round the flag, boys, rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. We will rally from the hillside, gather from the plain, shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever, hurrah, boys, hurrah. Down with the traitor and up with the star, while we rally round the flag, boys, rally once again, shouting.
Our brothers gone before, shouting the battle cry of freedom.
And we'll fill the vacant ranks with a million free men more, shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever, hurrah, boys, hurrah. Down with the traitor and up with the star, while we rally round the flag, boys, rally once. again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. We will welcome to our numbers the loyal, true, and brave, shouting the battle cry of freedom. And although they may be poor, not a man shall be a slave, shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever! Hurrah, boys, hurrah! Down with the traitor and up with the star, while we rally round the flag, boys, rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. While we rally round the flag, boys, rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom.
And that was the Weavers from their album Wasn't That a Time. One of those mixed songs, that rallying around the flag stuff. I don't think too much of the flag these days, given where it's been, what it's doing overseas. However, in theory, and in the old days, and perhaps in the future, who knows, flag might be reclaimed as a good thing. I've usually been involved in flag burnings rather than flag blessings, so usually the flag is a symbol of tyranny in foreign countries because of the United States' imperial empire, which the flag symbolizes these days. However, it I'd like to say it wasn't always, and maybe in a certain sense it wasn't. Anyway, for me, the ideals are important, and I hope that's true for you too. Self-determination for all people, freedom, justice, all that kind of thing. The stuff you learned about in school, then you had to memorize all the wretched details of the system of government that we actually we have, but that doesn't really talk about the reality. You know, you got the two houses of Congress and the executive and the legislative and judiciary. What you really have is a plutocracy ruled by the wealthy, and there isn't much discussion of that. At least there wasn't when I was in school. Hopefully times will be changing, and maybe the situation will be changing. That would be even better, although it doesn't look like it's getting any better at the moment. So, as mentioned before, this is Free Radio, and we are streaming at freakradio.org. The show is archived at Huff Santa Cruz, HUFFSantaCruz.org. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom is a civil rights organization. We meet every Wednesday. We met yesterday. And we're going to be doing some protesting. I'll probably be present at our usual spot for the ninth successive week, downtown on Pacific Avenue, demanding an end to laws that criminalize poor and homeless people, specifically the sleeping ban law, and specifically dramatizing the fact that Merchants and the Downtown Association has been lending itself to the increased crackdown downtown that the city council has gone along with, that the police department has been pushing, and that has nothing to do with real crime and real security, but rather has to do with moving away a whole population of people who are perceived to be unprofitable and unattractive. And the fact that they're human, of course, doesn't really enter into the equation. Obviously it doesn't, because why would you have a law that makes it illegal to sleep after 11 o'clock at night outside when there's no shelter, so that you have to get a $97 ticket if a police officer chooses to move on you, giving police officers these kinds of powers, power to search, power to harass, power to wake at midnight, has been something that I've been talking about for decades, something that remains, and something that we've got to resist. And we were going to be doing that Saturday at 2 o'clock downtown in front of Bunny's Shoes. So come join us there if you'd like. And the reason we're in front of Bunny's has to do with the fact that Bunny's and three other stores signed declarations that helped the city attorney to criminalize two homeless musicians, making it not just a crime to sleep anywhere in the city, which it always is, but a jailing crime for these two to sleep anywhere downtown. That's going a step too far, and we decided to dramatize the issue in front of the stores who actually supported this stuff. And we're encouraging boycotts, at least I am, of those stores. And we're also encouraging people to check out stores that post the pledge, which actually just talks about the right to sleep not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere. That is to say, campgrounds, car parks, designated zones, places where people can go without having to worry about being hassled or harassed by the police, and hopefully without being overly surveyed, overly searched, overly controlled, overly socially monitored. So that's kind of the theme of the show, the theme of the protest, and we also are going to be covering a number of other subjects, which I'm going to pull out of a hat because I've got a lot of clippings I brought with me. And I've also got a lot of audio that I haven't played. In fact, I'm going to pick up the audio right now from where I was playing it on Sunday. I have a Sunday show, as most of you regular listeners know. I imagine all of you regular listeners know. As some of you listeners may, who aren't regular may not know. It's every Sunday from 9:30 to 1 in the afternoon. And I come in a little early and play flashbacks. Here's a, not a flashback, actually just a week or two ago. I believe this is July, I guess July 19th or July 20th. And this is an interview that I began playing on Sunday with a woman holding up a sign that said, well, she'll describe it, I think, in the course of this interview. It's smile if you masturbate, give me a dollar per smile, or something to that effect. A little adolescent, a little humorous, a little off color, but, well, something that the police have been harassing her for. And here she is to talk about it.
Okay, well, it is Monday evening. Cool night, and it's about 10:15 in the evening. I'm here at Cathcart and Cedar talking with
Al Johnson, Mom the Music Man.
And Al is here. He's going to play a little something for us.
And as usual, this is not what I had in mind, but let's hear what Al has to say, and we'll catch up with the much maligned signer in a moment.
I've come 3,000 miles.
And actually, I think what I'm going to do is take a breather. This is actually, sadly enough, at the wrong spot in the tape. So let's hear a little music, and I'll be back. To have no fear, this will be set up properly. I thought for sure it was, but here we go. Here's another quick tune from the Weavers.
Que bonita bandera, que bonita bandera, que bonita bandera es la bandera puertorriqueña. Qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera es la bandera puertorriqueña. Qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera es la bandera puertorriqueña.
En el año 1891 nació la enseña de que cantamos la bandera de Puerto Rico.
Qué bonita bandera, bonita bandera es la bandera puertorriqueña. Qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera es la bandera puertorriqueña.
Asegurada con la solitaria estrella.
Qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera es la bandera puertorriqueña.
Qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera es la bandera puertorriqueña. Cuba libre y Puerto Rico también, abajo la tiranía y que viva mi borinquén.
Qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera es la bandera puertorriqueña. Qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera es la bandera puertorriqueña.
Qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera.
Qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera.
bonita bandera es la bandera puertorriqueña. Qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera, qué bonita bandera es la bandera puertorriqueña.
And that was another Weaver's special, Que Bonita Bandera. And that shows you the true bilingual nature of this program. Not necessarily that I can tell you why the bandera is bonita, but there it is. Here we go with the interview I promised before, actually faithfully put together and indexed and hopefully audible, so stay tuned.
With the woman in front of Borders, it's about 25 to 11. Your name, madam?
Melissa.
Melissa, last time I saw you had a sign, what is it, smile if you masturbate and give me a quarter? Or what?
Spare a dollar if you smile.
Oh, right, right. And smile if you masturbate.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a common practice among those of us who are still alive.
Of course, of course.
Now, you say that Officer Warren had a comment about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was following it for a while, and there are some people who are obviously going to have complaints and that don't agree with it. But the thing is, there is the First Amendment, and that is the freedom of speech that I
would think so, wouldn't you?
Yes. It's
not, not in Santa Cruz for Officer Warren, apparently.
Right, right. He came up to me the other day and said that my sign was causing disturbing people. And so he just said that I couldn't fly it. And I said, well, I know the cops have, like, had a discussion about my sign or whatever, but they all agreed that I could fly it as long as I held it down when kids were walking by, which I have been. But he told me
that... You don't want kids to learn what the word masturbate means? Or?
I suppose not. And any kid that knows how to read it...
They might grow hair on their palms, right?
Right. But
or on their fingertips.
But Officer Warren said that because it bothered him that I couldn't fly it. And I said... You know, well,
actually, the First Amendment was made for everybody but Officer Warren. He has the right to suspend it when he wants.
Of course, because he is a police officer after all. You know, he should.
When did he tell you this?
Yeah, so he just told me that if he saw me flying it again, he would cite me just because.
Or what?
It offended him. He didn't like it.
There's no law that says you can't offend Officer Warren. That is not a law either in the Santa Cruz Code, the State Penal Code, or, as far as I know, a federal law. In fact, there's a law that says you can offend Officer Warren. That's the First Amendment, provided you don't violate other laws. But he didn't give you another law.
Right. I just need to learn how to argue with the cops because I just don't.
I understand. I mean, who wants to argue with somebody with a gun and a bunch of body armor?
Exactly. And a paper to write your name on and give you a ticket for.
Right, a whole file on you and a bunch of other people to back him up. But when did you have this conversation with Officer Warren?
Oh, shoot. It wasn't yesterday. I believe it was the day before yesterday. And I think, like, the reason that I had more complaints yesterday than the other day than usual is because I let my friend, that was a guy, hold the sign for about 10 minutes. He was walking up and down, and I don't know if he had as much courtesy as I did with the sign, but after that, I guess there were more complaints, so it's kind of a double standard thing at the same time. Because I'm a female, I could probably fly it longer than a guy that tried to come out here and fly it.
Good directions, too.
What time of day was it when he talked to you?
Oh, goodness.
Where did he talk to you?
It was still, like... I don't know, maybe like 4-ish. It was almost 4 o'clock. I remember now because I was gonna write him a ticket and put it on his car for disturbing the peace, but I decided against it because
you were disturbing the police and he was disturbing the peace.
Exactly.
Or let's put it this way, upsetting the Constitution. Where did you talk to him?
It was actually right over here in front of Borders.
And were there any witnesses to what Officer Warren said?
I'm not sure who was around at the time, but anybody who's around when the cops hassle me for the sign, everybody, like, usually I make a couple dollars just because of getting a ticket. I've gotten 3 already for the sign, mostly because I've been too close to building or too close to other people.
B.O.B. And what kind of tickets have you got?
I have 2 tickets for being a...
Close to a building.
Yeah, within 14.
And handling in a group.
Yeah.
I got those 2 the last time we talked. What about the third one?
The that was the panhandling in a group. Two of them were for being too close to a building. And
were you blocking traffic?
No.
Were you blocking an entrance?
That's what he said that I was blocking traffic. But the thing is, I was talking to these guys who happened to like my sign, so I stopped in the middle and they were talking to me, and like, you know, we were engaging
in social interaction.
Exactly.
People were able to get past you if they wanted.
Yeah, exactly.
So you weren't blocking traffic.
Yeah, and then the other guy.
Warren was expressing his power.
I'm not sure if that was Warren that time. There's
different officer. Sorry, Officer Warren.
But I never keep the tickets, so I don't exactly remember who gives them out all the time, because I don't see any reason to, you know. But thing is, even the guy who was talking to me was just walking down the street and gave me a dollar. He tried to like defend me against the cop, and he actually snapped at the other guy too and just said, "Do you want a ticket too?" And so the guy kind of backed off. But
a little commentary here, although this kind of speaks for itself. We have a matrix of downtown ordinances which allow police discretion, apparently, since they don't want to bother to run around ticketing everybody who isn't sitting exactly more than 14 feet away from a building, 14 away from a bench, 14 feet away from a crosswalk, and so forth. So it becomes somewhat discretionary. So if Officer Warren or some other officer doesn't like the sign about, you know, smile if you masturbate, spare a dollar if you smile, then the officer can come up and pick and choose to harass you if he can find some other law that you're violating, or simply start warning you from his ex cathedra position, from his on high position, that you just can't do it, or he'll ticket you for something, which is apparently what the officer did, if Melissa is telling us the truth. And when it's another person, another member of the community says, "Wait a minute, you know, what are you doing, officer? It's none of your business to interfere with a person on the street with a sign like this," which is a natural thing to say. We would defend each other's rights in this society against bullies of one sort or another, whatever badge they're wearing, or whatever uniform they're dressed in, even whatever weapon they happen to have strapped on their belt, or whatever legal document they have to show what a high abuha they are. The cop turns to him, or whoever it was who defended Melissa, and says, "Get going or I'll ticket you too." If you believe Melissa, but frankly, I do. It sounds like a pretty straightforward story, and it sounds typical of the kind of abuse of power that happens regularly on Pacific Avenue and will continue to happen because of the overfunding, of the over-policing of the police department, all the cries and groans and screams of the city council about the budget crisis notwithstanding. In fact, what you have is more money being poured into the police department to retain policing on Pacific Avenue, both at the behest of the Downtown Association, that happened at the last city council. They apparently were funneling money to a cop in a kind of a suspicious manner through the city council. That didn't look good, so the city council decided to fund this cop directly, and they restored the funding for this police officer. And I'm not too sure, by the way, about the prior funding, so that's not holy writ. That's what I'm kind of gleaning from trying to read between the lines and read the lines of comments on the Sentinel Topic website, which is not the best source of information. These are the comments that are appended to Sentinel on air, the Sentinel on the web stories that you read in the paper, and then you go to the Sentinel and read the comments on the stories. But there's also a story, which I may get to in this pile of papers I have sitting to my left here, about how the federal government is kicking down a couple of million, or maybe $1.5 million to the Santa Cruz Police Department, so they can, you know, restore cops at the same time as no money is being spent to restore the social services that have been slashed locally and statewide. Instead, you're going to have more incentive and more juice for the police to run around doing the kind of thing you're hearing them doing on Pacific Avenue through Melissa's account from July 20th. Here's more.
The guy should have said, "Sure, go ahead, but what are you going to take it before, officer?
Right.
We could take it to civil court." But, you know, you don't have to say it at all. In fact, it'd be interesting if I carried that sign off. I don't think Officer Warren would ticket me, but maybe he would. It would be interesting. You do have to find a lawyer if you want to sue, and it takes a long time. And,
yeah,
you know, there's always an uncertainty.
Money, which
and it takes money, got to do that too. So, anyway, last time the police contacted you was when? That incident 2 days ago with Officer Moore?
Last summer that I had a discussion with him.
Well, any kind of contact with him?
Well, I guess right now we're just holding up some palm frond roses that we made right in front of Borders. But I was talking to you as this happened, but I guess the police told us to leave, so we packed up our stuff.
And which officer told you to leave?
Sure, B.O.B. would know.
B.O.B.?
B.O.B.
Name of the cop who told you to leave was?
He was in a car. So.
And what did he say?
He just told me to pack up and leave. He said, get out of here right now.
I see. Because he didn't like your hat, or what exactly was you were doing that was illegal?
Pretty much selling things after dark, or not selling things, asking for donations after dark.
You can ask for donations. Usually, however, you have to do some kind of act, or else you'll be accused of panhandling, which is illegal after dark.
Well, we were just had a display of roses and a grasshopper out of pom poms.
Shocking. I'm going to leave you to consider the consequences of your criminal behavior. Music for free radio, guitarist, or something.
Are you going to put us on free radio?
Well, I always, put everything on free radio. But usually just snatches of it,
What's that?
We're here on the Pacific Trading Company, and we got two men with guitars and a couple of other guys with ears. We're all here listening, waiting for the sounds of the night. That is it, the sounds of the night. And we have a lone guitarist here in the breezeway next to the still abandoned Suite 100B and the bubble lounge.
Spooky little girl like you. Spooky. You always keep me thinking, you always keep me guessing. I never seem to know what you are thinking.
And our guitarist from here is playing in the front of the Cooper House Mall, the locked gate at night. Of course, he's illegal because his display device, his open guitar case, now it's closed actually, is within 10 feet of the building. But the sound is nice. Thank you. We have some people listening to this music. What do you think of the music, folks?
Beautiful.
Amazing.
Awesome, yo.
Any reports from the street about police behavior? No problems?
We've only been here for a couple days. We haven't had too much issue.
Traveling together?
I got a camping ticket.
Right. Oh, where was that?
We've been here at the beach.
And who gave you that? A city police officer?
It was a state
ranger?
Yeah, the ranger is one of them.
What did he say to you?
He tried to tell me where I could go and where I couldn't go.
He actually had some place to tell you to go? Where would that be?
No, he just was telling me that I couldn't be on the beach, and he told me not to go to Florida.
He suggests floating above the water, perhaps? You could actually float on the water. I guess that would be legal.
Maybe.
Build yourself a raft. Now, then you might need to get a permit. I don't know.
I just thought it was kind of crazy because I protect the forest, and then I can't sleep where I want to sleep, in the forest.
Can't sleep anywhere with you. I want to sleep there or not. So how long have you been in Santa Cruz?
Only 4 days, 3 days.
2 days.
Where are you from?
I'm originally from Boulder, Colorado.
And recently?
Yeah, well, kind of recently.
And what is your name?
Styx.
And you are?
Rekev.
And?
Antonio.
any impressions of Santa Cruz you wish to pass on to the free radio audience?
I would say watch camping on the beach, yo. It's not a free country anymore.
Now, were you camping alone or were you with a group of people?
I was by myself.
And how many park rangers caught up with you?
One.
Did you say there had been a complaint?
Nope.
Did he offer you a legal place to go?
Nope.
What time did he give you a ticket?
It was probably 5 or 6 in the morning, right at dawn.
What was he doing at dawn on the beach?
Not being a lifeguard, that's for sure.
Were there anybody else on the beach?
There was a couple of people just walking their dogs early in the morning.
So dogs have, but maybe luckily they weren't sleeping, or else he wouldn't have let sleeping dogs walk.
Yeah, they wouldn't let sleeping dogs
walk. Or maybe he would. Sleeping people know, sleeping dogs, yes.
Maybe.
We've been talking.
Like a lot more different species have more privileges than we do, even as a human being.
It's a lot more care put into the SPCA than the homeless shelters.
Yeah, and the homeless shelters are so overcrowded, they should let us sleep where we want to sleep, or where we can sleep. You know,
they have some camping spots where people can go.
Yeah, no doubt.
They don't have.
No doubt.
We've been talking with?
Sticks.
And?
Brecker.
And not really much with, but still here is...
Anthony.
Thank you. And in case I haven't mentioned it before, it's Monday evening, the 20th of July. We're talking with a constitutional expert in a wheelchair, a man who knows cats. Your name, sir?
I'm the cat man.
You are the cat man. Where is your kitty?
She's right down here on the sidewalk.
Oh, it's true. She's right beside you there.
She's sitting on the sidewalk.
She's sitting next to a bench, within 14 feet of a bench, actually within 10 feet of
but
a bench.
But she's not a human being. She's not a human being.
She's got more rights than a human being.
So I guess she does have more rights than
cats
a human being.
Cats actually have more rights.
The sign says no dogs. It doesn't say no cats.
Dogs.
It doesn't say no pets.
Actually, it does say that, yeah, kitties and rabbits
no
certainly have more rights than dogs, and certainly more rights than, well... People,
which I can understand.
Dogs aren't even allowed to
shit on the ground.
Dogs,
nobody wants to fucking have to clean that
poor,
shit up.
Well, poor dog, enough shit on the ground.
Nobody wants to have to smell.
No,
nobody wants
no,
to
no if you, you know, if you were shitting on the ground, that would be another issue because that's a crime. But
a lot
just
of people don't
walking,
want to barking
just
dogs.
Walking on the ground is a crime if you're a dog.
Nobody and has to worry, want to
here
worry
in Santa
about
Cruz
a dog
on the Pacific Avenue
when they're walking past the dog.
A dog. Can
there's a lot of things you got to worry about with a dog.
Yeah, well.
With a cat, you
what about what about a grumpy character in a wheelchair with a strange hat. What about that?
Well, as long as you are pretty nice to him, he's pretty nice back.
He's not, well.
Yeah. It's legal for a dog to sleep in a bush.
But not legal for a human being in Santa Cruz to sleep after 11 o'clock at night outside. That's correct. There's a dog across the street. Of course, there's a bunch of people across the street, too. Well, we've been talking with Catman, and of course, that expert is still sitting on the bench. I don't know. I mean, you must have been here for at least 10 minutes. I have to keep an eye on you. I have my watch with me. What's your name, bench sitter?
Sir Didymus.
Sir Didymus, I haven't seen any police officers or hosts out tonight. That's one of the virtues, I guess. I guess they occasionally drive by in their vehicles.
One just went by.
Oh, we have one.
Well, you got somebody keep looking after your interests downtown.
Well, the shops are closed, and it's Monday, though.
Yes, sir. It's kind of a slow day.
Yeah, you never know when a mugger might show up.
Or somebody with a tape recorder.
So it's good to have a cop nearby.
I will leave you to your police protection. Thank you, gentlemen. As we walk up the street, we are approaching the guitarists who were a little shy about playing music before, but you can get a sample of what they're playing as I walk by the Pacific Trading Company area. A little percussion, a little music. And it is after the infamous 10 o'clock deadline. You're allowed to play music, but the volume has to drop and the standard becomes different. All right, strum on, you guys. And there you are. Music on the mall. Near the A. van der Kloof pendulum, even. A large pendulum structure that sits near the Pacific Trading Company. The second-hand report from...
Shay.
And...
Jeremiah.
So this was... Saturday night, I guess, huh?
I suppose. Can't remember.
I was in rehab when that happened.
But you heard a report from you from an excited and crazy person or a reliable person or
I heard it from one of my friends. I was actually sober and just saw it.
What did she or he tell you?
She was like, "Whoa, what the fuck, dude? The cops just beat the shit out of this guy for no reason, like beat him to the ground." I was like, "Oh, really?" But I was like in a hurry to get somewhere, so I started walking down Pacific, and then I overheard like these yuppies talking about it too.
Where exactly did this happen?
It was like in front of the metro by the Greyhound where I heard them talking about it.
Mm-hmm. And what did they say that you noticed? If you remember.
I wasn't really there. I was down the street, but they just said the cops beat the shit out of some guy.
Yeah, there's no apparent reason at all.
Yeah.
They bust out their nightsticks and dink, dink, good night.
And you heard this from a different group of people or from the same?
No, from the same people.
If you were together. Well, I want more reports. I want photographs. I want tapes. So in the future,
I want to see
carry
your
camera
website.
With you. All right. As soon as
I would love to. I'd love you to get a quote from the officer.
Officer Winston. We'll see what he has to say.
Yeah. Winston?
Yep.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
Well, he's got priors for
that
for
is what I heard from
people.
That is what I heard from one person, but
oh, wow.
I've not talked to anybody.
You know what I think
he's also. Officer Winston is also the one that threatened my friend that he was going to break his jaw.
And that was Officer Warren, I think.
Warren.
Yeah, it was Warren.
Warren.
But Winston, you know what I think about him and the rest of the cops? They're just they're just the kids in elementary school who got swirlies in the toilet and think they're the big guys now because they have a shiny badge and they can just beat up people.
Yeah, they got picked on, so they think they're on a power trip.
They are on a power trip.
With their guns and their nightsticks, and I don't think that should be legal at all.
Nope.
Think of the law.
Any other reports from the street that you folks want to pass on to Free Radio?
No, everything's going great out here with the street kids. We're all getting along pretty much, and you know, we're all about
to love. How's the food situation? Do people use?
Oh, it's great.
Dennis Adams meals everywhere.
A lot of the tourists out here are kind enough to give us their leftovers, and
there's resources.
We enjoy it.
What resources, Shay, do you regularly use?
Sometimes no, not the shelter, St. Francis and the Red Church.
Yes,
but not the homeless services center.
I don't really go there; it's too far.
Best food there, and it's like jail meals, and it reminds me too much of eating in jail because they have the same trays.
There you have
it.
We've been talking with.
You forgot your name?
Jeremiah
and
Shay.
And off to the side.
And AJ.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Have a nice.
And of course, you may remember from a week ago when I had Doug Loisel on the show here. He's the head of the Homeless Services Center, the executive director out there, you know, where the meals, according to Jeremiah, because of the trays, remind him of prison food. I haven't been out there to eat in years, so I can't really speak to the quality of the food, though I haven't heard that much criticism of it. In fact, I've heard some praise that these meals are now going to cost 50 cents as of August 1st, which I guess is rolling right up, today being the 30th. I guess that'll be Saturday, August 1st, and there's been some grumbling about that, though not enough to get people to come to the Huff meetings to want to actually do any organized opposition, although, hey, Huff meets every Wednesday, and again, we'll also at 9:30 at the Sub Rosa Cafe, 703 Pacific Avenue, and we're also going to be at Bunny Shoes at 2 o'clock on Saturday. That's day after tomorrow, and that's at, I think that's 1350 Pacific Avenue, if I'm not mistaken. It's right next to the Palomar Hotel, next to the Hat Company, down on Pacific Avenue, in the thick of things. And so talk to us there, or give me a call on the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM. Also known as Freak Radio Santa Cruz. It's www.freakradio.org. You want to be on the air yourself. You want a show, perhaps. Hey, well, go to the Freak Radio website and download an application and send it in. Prepare some kind of an audio or tape and let us know. And, you know, we may well have a spot for you. It's there's almost always places open. Sometimes they're a little bit obscure, you know, like in the wee hours, but there usually are some primetime spots open. People have been trying to cut down on my spot for years. They think I talk too much on the air, and so you might be able to get a slice of my time. You never can tell. Again, that's freakradio.org. And we need some programmers who are willing to come in and do work around the morning, putting on the shows that are so beloved of our upper-middle-class listeners, like Democracy Now!, I actually listen to Democracy Now! Myself, but it's downloadable off the Internet, so I've often wondered why we bother to play it here on Free Radio. I guess it's because some people don't have computers in their cars. I mean, I don't. And don't want to wait to download it later at home, and I guess some people don't have computers at all. But I'm a big fan of local programming. But whatever your interests are, if you want to become involved with Free Radio, you can. Again, www.freakradio.org. If you want to leave a message on the message line for more information of a particular question you may have, 427-4523, 427-4523. If you want to call this show right now and tell me what you think of what's cooking, or you have some reports from the street, or just some reactions to what you've heard, the number to call is 427-3772, 427-FRSC. So you think about that while I play a little music for you. And then we'll get on with some more interviews.
We are all mouse down to the shore. Peter, Peter, on the sea, drop your nets and follow me. We are all mouse down to the shore.
fight on,
fight on,
fight on,
fight on.
Children don't,
children don't
turn back,
don't turn back.
We are all,
we are
almost down,
almost down
to the shore,
we're almost down to the shore.
I said fight on,
fight on,
fight on,
fight on.
Children and don't,
children don't
turn back,
don't turn back.
We are all,
we are
almost down,
almost down
to the shore,
we are almost down to the shore.
God told Moses on the mountaintop, he said keep on a-going and don't you stop. We are all almost down to the shore. Fight on,
fight on,
fight on,
fight on.
Children don't,
children don't,
don't you turn back,
don't turn back.
We are all,
we are
almost down,
almost down
to the shore.
We're almost down to the shore.
Fight on,
we're almost down,
fight on,
we're almost down.
Children don't,
we're almost down,
turn back. Moses gotta stay behind. We are all,
children don't turn back,
almost down,
children don't turn back
to the shore.
We're almost down to the shore.
Walk together by God's command, bound to reach the promised land.
We are all almost down to the shore.
Don't you turn back,
don't turn back.
We are all,
we are all,
we are almost down,
almost down
to the shore.
We're almost down to the shore.
On,
we're almost down,
on,
we're almost down.
Children go,
we're almost down,
don't turn back,
children don't turn back.
We are all,
we're almost down,
almost down,
we're almost down
to the shore.
We're almost down.
And that's Fight On, the Weavers. Interesting, kind of pick up a few tales from the newspaper here. This is, newspapers are a really interesting and rich source if you're going to dig deeply enough. It's true that you can't really get much out of the headlines. In fact, you can get misled a lot by corporate media. But if you go down into the details of the stories, you find some interesting stuff, particularly, for example, if you're a San Francisco Chronicle reader, now a dollar on the newsstand. In the last 3 days, the price has gone up, it looks like. And there's a section called the Bay Area section. This is the Section B. Here's an article. Officer who killed two fired for violating force policy in Oakland, by Henry K. Lee. An Oakland police officer who shot and killed two unarmed men in separate incidents within a year has been fired by the city for violating department use of force policies in the more recent shootings, his attorney said Saturday. Officer Hector Jimenez was terminated earlier this month in connection with the 2008 shooting death of Mac Jody Woodfox III, 27, in the city's Fruitvale district, said Jimenez's attorney Justin Buffington. Woodfox was shot three times in the back, his family said. The department said Jimenez violated use of force policies because Woodfox no longer posed a threat to the officer at the time of the shooting, Buffington said. Perhaps he was attacking him with his back. But the attorney said the firing was completely inappropriate and Jimenez will appeal. I don't think the department wanted to terminate him but had to terminate him for political reasons. I'll bet. Buffington said, referring to the public outcry that resulted because Jimenez had shot and killed two people within 7 months. Officer Jeff Thomason, department spokesman, said he could not comment because it was a personnel issue. Oakland police have said that Jimenez, who graduated from the police academy in February 2007, fired numerous shots at Woodfox on July 25, 2008, hitting him in the back. Jimenez said he believed Woodfox, a drunken driving suspect, was reaching into his waistband for a gun when he jumped from his car and ran from the police. The chase ended at East 17th Street and Fruitvale Avenue. Woodfox was not armed, however, and his family filed a $10 million federal civil rights suit against the city of Oakland and Jimenez that is still pending. The complaint cited a previous fatal shooting involving Jimenez as evidence that the officer was poorly trained. On New Year's Eve 2007, Jimenez and Officer Jessica Borrello shot and killed 20-year-old Andrew Maupin Buckskin at 47th Avenue and International Boulevard in Oakland after he ran from his car following a traffic stop, police said. Maupin Buskin was not armed, but the officers told investigators that they believed he had been reaching for, guess what, his waistband. The officers did not violate any policies, the department said. John Burris, an Oakland attorney representing the families of both men killed by Jimenez, said Saturday that he was gratified by the officer's termination. His conduct was egregious. A young man is dead who should not be dead, Burris said. Maybe two young men are dead who should not be dead. We thought this case not only warranted an information, but certainly warranted prosecution. Buffington disagreed. That's the attorney for the cop, saying his client is confident in his actions on both occasions, and he certainly felt he was put in a position where he had no choice. It's every cop's nightmare to have to use deadly force, and unfortunately he was confronted with circumstances that required it. Right, in both cases, people running away, in one, three shots in the back. And the sad thing about this is not only that the cop wasn't prosecuted, but that the police department was backing up this cop. Police officer said he did not violate any departmental policies. But they guess they had to fire him anyway. Why? Because of the public outcry. And therein is the lesson for us. And that's why we're protesting downtown on Pacific Avenue. It is to alert the public to see what is going on underneath the smiley facade of Pacific Avenue. That is to say, when the police come, as they have in the last 3 weeks, to try to take away our table because merchants nearby or residents nearby or who knows who nearby decides they don't want a political table on the public sidewalk because they feel that it's, an eyesore, uncomfortable. We don't even know who these people are because the police, although it's a public record, will not tell us. In order to get that record, you have to pay for the transcript of the 911 tape or you have to find some way to get access to it. Police could tell us. And why should a person who thinks that she or he sees a crime be afraid of talking about it? They're afraid of retaliation, perhaps, is the claim by the police officer. Well, if you're going to accuse someone of criminal activity of this kind, your responsibility is to stand up and say, I saw this, I didn't like it, I feel it's a criminal behavior. And if you don't do that, and if the police cover for you, then what's going on here is public spaces are being swept clean of First Amendment rights. Where if the First Amendment can only work for an hour in front of a particular business, what does that do to labor organizations that are picketing or boycotting that business? It means they can't set up a table on the sidewalk. It would be different if somebody else wanted to use that space. It would be different if there were some real legitimate health and safety concerns. But what we have here, again, is simply an attack on unpopular political opinion, particularly political opinion that's unpopular with a segment of the downtown, the downtown association, merchants, police, where we're exposing the fact that they have a whole bunch of anti-homeless laws masquerading as bad behavior laws, which are being used to essentially gentrify and socially and ethnically cleanse Pacific Avenue. Ethnically is probably inappropriate. We don't have enough ethnicity to even cleanse it in Santa Cruz, although you do have some Hispanic folks. In fact, I hear tell that 50% of the county is now Spanish-speaking. Hence the increase in Spanish-speaking programming on Free Radio Santa Cruz. But all you Spanish-speaking free radio programmers, I would encourage you also to, keep things going so that both Spanish and English-speaking people are encouraged to listen to the shows. And hopefully that will happen. I'm not much of a programmer myself in that regard. I'm just sort of an onlooker. I do a show twice a week. And hopefully I touch on some of these issues. So, again, the three lessons to be learned from this story about the dauntless officer Jimenez, who shot dead two men in Oakland while having his uniform on and has now been fired from the Oakland Police Department, probably picked up by another police department. In fact, I'll try to take a look and see if Hector Jimenez has been on the news in some other way, although probably that wouldn't be happening because this is a pretty recent story. This is from June 21st Chronicle. It took a public outcry to get rid of this cop and to raise the issue. The department rubber-stamped what happened, and there's no prosecution for murder or manslaughter. So it's smooth sailing for the killers on the police force. You know, I don't know if it was murder, I don't know if it was manslaughter. I certainly couldn't have been self-defense when someone is running the other direction from you in a drunk driving case. You know, thank you very much. Maybe it's the training police officers are getting. Maybe the idea is, you know, track down these people at all costs and shoot them if they don't stop. Or it's hard to tell. I mean, he claimed that he shot the guy because he was reaching for his waistband. That was exactly the excuse. Well, that was the later excuse used in the Happy John Dine shooting in 1997 here in Santa Cruz when Officer Connor Carey killed Happy John Dine at the corner of Front and Soquel. First, the claim was that he was waving a pistol and holding in a combat position, which turned out to be a toy gun, when all the other non-police witnesses said there was no such thing as happened. Then he was reaching for it, and that was the next story that developed. Sounds a little like the Oscar Grant III case, and we have a BART police officer, Johannes Messerli, claiming that he mistook his taser, his gun for a taser, which, as I've described, is almost impossible to do because tasers require charging up. They're brightly colored. They're big. They have a different weight. It's a desperate story that the attorneys are cooking up because everything else is falling apart and he's charged with murder. But that's even that story wouldn't be coming out unless there were the kind of high-profile protest that happened after Oscar Grant III was shot dead, some say executed, on the Fruitvale BART platform on the evening of January 1st. In fact, I think what I'm going to do here is do a little reading from an article that you can find in the East Bay Indie Bay, on the East Bay Indie Bay website. It's called Bring the Ruckus Responds to Advance the Struggle on the Oscar Grant Rebellion. Bring the Ruckus as a group. Bring the Ruckus, Oakland, welcomes the release of the new pamphlet by Advance the Struggle. These are two kind of radical groups talking back and forth, entitled Justice for Oscar Grant, A Lost Opportunity. In the spirit of comradely and productive critique, we offer the following comments, which we hope will both build upon ideas developed in the pamphlet and also provoke further reflection on where to go from here. Justice for Oscar Grant, A Lost Opportunity, seeks to critically assess the organizational tools available to those who took to the streets in January 2009. According to Advance the Struggle, or AS, these tools primarily consisted of 1. The Coalition Against Police Executions, CAPE, a hastily assembled grouping composed largely of nonprofit sector leftists, and 2. A self-labeled revolutionary communist organization, the Avakianite Revolutionary Communist Party, or RCP. The major contribution of this pamphlet, we believe, lies in this double-sided critique of 2 elements, 2 organizational tools which on the surface share very little, but whose subtle similarities could be further developed. While CAPE, Coalition Against Police Executions, spent much of its time attempting to restrain the energies of the rebellion and channel these down reformist paths, young RCP, Revolutionary Communist Party cadres, were consistently in the streets inciting further mobilization. Advance the Struggle, AS, is correct, nevertheless, to highlight the underlying compatibility that both sectors shared. In other words, there are several roads. There are numerous roads. People can adopt their own approach to dealing with institutionalized police murder and cover-up, which is, I think, the case in the Oscar Grant shooting. While we appreciate this useful critique, however, continues the writer, we are left hoping for more vision of how to move revolutionary organizing in the Bay forward. This is not a critique, since we ourselves have not publicly offered a systematic, strategic vision of the coming months. This document is an effort to begin to make such a contribution and to begin to move forward together. Vanguardism, reformist, and revolutionary. A lot of this is sort of, I don't know, wordy, but let's see what we got here. Advance the Struggle skillfully recounts the essential moments of the January Rebellion, in which the initial intentions of the CAPE organizers, Coalition Against Police Executions, were quickly overwhelmed by the intuitive militancy of Oakland youth, who, against the claims about outside agitators passed from police to the media and regurgitated by CAPE itself, spearheaded the rebellions on January 7th, 14th, and 30th, against all calls for, quote, moderation and, quote, rational dialogue, this intuitive militancy demonstrated an astoundingly clear grasp of how the state functions. As C.L.R. James once put it, the rich are only defeated when running for their lives. It was only when the city of Oakland and Alameda County found their interests threatened that action was forced on the state and Johannes Merzely arrested. Despite this irrefutable logic of the rebellion, both objects of the AS critique would in their own way hinder the militancy of this momentous upsurge. Advance the Struggle discusses, as AS discusses, how nonprofits function as a buffer protecting the state, a role manifested physically on the night of January 14th, i.e. the very day after the state was forced to act for fear of a repeat of the demonstrations of the 7th, as the nonprofit security force faced down protesters, notably with their backs to police, to clear them off the streets with a combination of disgusting paternalism, we are here to protect you, and the internalized ideology of self-policing, we must therefore physically remove you for your own good. Members of Advance the Struggle and Ruckus were both at the CAPE meeting when this security strategy was proposed and pursued with near unanimity. The safety and effectiveness of the movement placed uncritically in the hands of black-clad professional security officers. In that meeting, decisions had already been made behind closed doors by non-profiteers, that is to say people non-profits who are profiteering, some with direct ties to the Dellums campaign. Ron Dellums, a former radical and a congressional representative and then the mayor of Oakland, compelled more by the desire to maintain their public image than to represent the righteous anger of those on the street. Predictably, when this force was deployed on the 14th, it found itself forced to repress the very people it claimed to represent, physically pushing them off the street. As one recent analysis describes the scene, CAPE's security force both sheltered the state in a very material way, working with police by fighting protesters, while simultaneously destroying the solidarity necessary for a successful movement, creating a snitch culture, threatening demonstrators with arrest, shaming people into nonviolence and passivity, profiling young people of color to determine if they were capable of thinking for themselves, i.e., resisting becoming the mindless pawns of, quote, outside agitators. And finally, stripping away the power and momentum that had been established in the January 7th uprising. But to this critique of the CAPE nonprofiteers operating as an arm of the state and who undoubtedly represented the fundamental barrier to continued mobilization, Advance the Struggle adds a critique of the Revolutionary Communist Party, the RCP. While many on the left refuse to even engage the RCP, the comical nature of their dogma should not prevent us from noting their impact on the ground. Many a young radical has joined the RCP due to the absence of serious revolutionary organizations active in the Bay. Given the RCP's failure to organize systematic campaigns with roots in the community, this means no more and no less than the detachment of young organic intellectuals from the revolutionary struggles that desperately need to be fought. The success of the RCP is therefore not something to be laughed at or dismissed out of hand, since it also represents our failure. While it is necessary to recognize that young RCP members were consistently present on the street, through a detailed and subtle analysis of a series of school walkouts, Advance the Struggle convincingly demonstrates the simultaneous ineffectiveness and even danger of the RCP approach to mobilizing. According to Advance the Struggle, the RCP fetishizes the function of having the correct political line, drawing their own motivation from the unquestioned line provided by Bob Avakian. The result is a mode of political organizing which often looks more like evangelism, a tautological circular form in which RCP mobilizes the community not for community needs, but to bolster their own ranks and readership. Struggles which do not fit into this preordained circularity, as Advance the Struggle scathingly notes, are dismissed as economistic and abandoned to nonprofits. The peculiar complementarity existing between the RCP and the nonprofits is then this. They constitute a circuit whereby revolutionaries refuse to engage community struggles, while those who do engage such struggles are far from revolutionary. That is to say, they're nonprofits. We are criticizing the RCP because in exalting themselves as representatives of communism and revolution, they discredit these worthy goals. Advance the Struggle therefore offers a simultaneous critique of reformist and revolutionary tendencies, despite the fact that the nonprofits and the so-called revolutionaries played very different roles on the street. this double critique is useful, and here we would just like to draw out the inherent similarity of the two positions, both of which mobilize popular resentment for their own dubious ends. Increased membership for the revolutionary RCP, bargaining power with the state, and cushy jobs for the nonprofits. The existence of organizations dedicated to mobilizing anger only to harness it toward their own ends has a long history, one which long predates the nonprofit industrial complex, and which constitutes a threat inherent to all efforts at revolutionary change, and which must be borne in mind constantly if we're to minimize its harmful effects. And there's a lot more. This is an article I've been reading. Just it's a little too, I think, obscure for those of you who've normally followed this show. If you don't like following the rhetoric and the internal debates of organizations that are trying to organize people around issues such as police misconduct, police murder, as was happening up in the East Bay around the Oscar Grant case. And what's really being discussed here is to try to understand both the drawbacks, the difficulties, and the advantages of each of these groups, because there's really kind of a debate going on. I mean, are you going to be a revolutionary? Are you going to be a reformist? If so, how do you do it? How does the community organize against police violence, and when it does organize, when it gets itself together, when people do come out on the streets, when they force change, how can that be sustained? I mean, that's the question. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse. Name of the show is Bathrobs, Pierre's Broadsides. Call-in number is 427-3772, and let's have an ancient musical break from the Weavers.
Our fathers bled at Valley Forge. The snow was red with blood, their faith was warm. At Valley Forge, their faith was brotherhood.
Wasn't that a time to thrive? The soul of man, wasn't that a terrible time?
At Gettysburg, now lying soldiers' graves, but there they stem. The slavery tide, and there the faith was saved.
Wasn't that a time to thrive? The soul of man, wasn't that a terrible time?
Fascists came with chains of war.
We dare to reach our hand to other neighbors, far and near, to friends in every land. Isn't this a time? Isn't this a time? A time to free the soul of man. Isn't this a wonderful time? Isn't this a wonderful time?
And continuing with my romp through the newspapers. Yeah. Here's another interesting obituary, something buried in an obituary of Ronald Takaki, who I'd never heard of before. Ronald Takaki is a professor who died recently at the age of 70, not so old. Here's his obituary. He didn't just talk about race and ethnicity. He helped redefine it. When students in the 1960s demanded the university start teaching American history that went beyond the lives of white people, Professor Takaki was one of the first to offer courses. As courses about race and ethnicity began to take shape, Professor Takaki elevated them to another level, creating the nation's first doctoral-level ethnic studies department at UC Berkeley. When he died in June, at his home in Berkeley, he'd created a legacy as one of the most influential scholars on race and ethnicity, wrote more than 20 books, Strangers from a Different Shore, A History of Asian Americans, Iron Cages, Race and Culture in the 19th Century America, Ethnic Islands, The Emergence of Urban Chinese America, and Double Victory, A Multicultural History of America in World War II, grew up among Japanese plantation workers in Hawaii, went to the College of Worcester in Ohio. He told the Chronicle in 2003 it altered him profoundly when he came to UC Berkeley in the 1960s to study history. I was born intellectually and politically in Berkeley in the 1960s. He was moved by the moral vision of Martin Luther King Jr. to join the free speech movement. The slaying of student activists registering voters in Mississippi inspired Takaki to do a study of slavery for his doctoral dissertation. And here's the reason I actually brought this obituary up, this actual paragraph. The Watts Riot in 1965 helped push UCLA to develop the first course in black history a year later, Takaki told the Chronicle. He was asked to teach it. And the point here is you often hear people denouncing violence and denouncing rioting that happened in the 60s or the rioting that happened in Korea in the late 80s. Or the rioting that is happening in Iran, although when it serves U.S. political interests, of course, that's the good guys rioting, you know, against the great dictators. But in fact, as I think was mentioned in the previous article around Oscar Grant, the guy shot in the BART station, it sometimes takes violence to awaken. To awaken the society to what's going on. The reality is, let's put it this way, resistance, violent resistance is one thing that you see and you become, you know, upset by and certainly concerned with, you know, and it makes one feel more insecure. You don't want yourself hurt. You don't want your friends hurt. You don't want innocent people, even innocent police officers hurt. You don't want anybody hurt or property damaged. However, if there is an ongoing regime of violence every day, where people are put into a prison system which kills at least one person a week in California alone because of inadequate health care. And that's documented. That's the reason that the whole prison system is in receivership at the state level now. It's been taken out of the hands of the state authorities by the federal courts because the health system is so bad that it's killing the prisoners one a week, either through suicide or through inadequate health care. And this kind of violence you don't hear about, you know. I mean, this is business as usual. And if it takes a rebellion from people on the streets that involves other kinds of violence, at times that can be beneficial, at times it's necessary. And there are many people who have called for it over the years at different times. I myself am not particularly good at violence, and I'm not calling for it at this particular moment for sure. But I simply point that out because it becomes an issue when some people insist dogmatically there can be no violence in a resistance movement. It's just not, I think, it closes doors that and shuts off allies that need to be, and it denigrates people who need to be respected and their motivations and their actions understood. More clippings. Some of them I'm a little hard for me to read here, but let's see what we've got here. 366-day sentence for pot dispensary owner in test case. This is a month old. You may have heard of this already. Federal judge sentenced the owner of a Central California medical marijuana dispensary to a year and a day in prison Thursday, spurning the Obama administration's push to give the defendants 5 years of imprisonment in a test case of the new federal policies towards state pot laws. So you may have heard that the reason that Lynn Robinson and Ryan Coonerty and Mike Rodkin on the city council wants to establish a medical marijuana moratorium for 10 months, and frankly, I have not gotten the action agenda, so I can't really say what happened at the last council meeting. I wasn't there. I'm going to give you a fuller report on Sunday when I come back and do a longer show. But they initially voted without question, without debate, on an emergency rule to shut down all medical marijuana dispensary applications. Even though we have very restrictive rules, there's already a very elaborate process for getting a permit. I talked about this at length. It's an anti-marijuana, pro-police position that's sort of, it's like a throwback position. You know, it's not quite a throwback to slavery, but it's in defense of drug war hysteria. And what one of the pretexts for doing this was, there's going to be all these applications coming into Santa Cruz because the feds are now so lenient. Well, this is an example of how lenient the feds are. They wanted a 5-year sentence for a guy who is the operator of the Central Coast Compassionate Caregivers in Morro Bay, San Luis Obispo County. Federal courts have ruled that our state Proposition 215, the 1996 state initiative, which allows patients to use the drug with their doctor's approval, is no defense in a charge of violating U.S. laws prohibiting marijuana possession, cultivation, and distribution. And the prosecutors, the federal prosecutors, Obama's federal prosecutors still wanted 5 years for this. But the federal judge refused and only gave him a 1-year sentence, which is being appealed. Obviously, of course, he should be getting a medal and not a sentence. And that, of course, is the real problem. And the city council, our city council's claim that the feds have suddenly become very sweet and nice on this issue, and that's why they were going to be getting a whole bunch of applications for marijuana dispensaries. That's why we have to shut everything down until God knows when, except for the two existing dispensaries, who will now then have a monopoly, Greenway and Ken Sampson's club, is hogwash, horseshit, nonsense. And it's too bad that it isn't challenged in a more, you know, in a broader media where people could understand it, see it more clearly, identify it for what it is, and resist it with the kind of public protest that, for example, prompted the indictment of Johannes Merzli. I'm not saying you have to break windows, but some raised voices would be a good idea here. Here's a story, tentative deal to improve medical care. The Schwarzenegger administration and a federal court appointee have agreed to a framework of a legal settlement to overhaul the way medical care is delivered to prison inmates. The plan includes building two prison hospitals to house 3,400 inmates at a cost of $1.9 billion. It was a concession to the fiscal reality of the current $24.3 billion state California budget deficit. The state would end the lawsuit attempting to terminate the receivership. As I mentioned before, the entire prison system is in receivership at the state level because it's killing its prisoners. And they have not been spent. They're spending more money on all kinds of other things except for health concerns. It's like this huge prison-building juggernaut is out of control. They want to create more and more prisons as essentially kind of execution centers, not in the same way, of course, that extermination centers were set up by different groups for genocidal purposes. But, blacks are disproportionately represented in jail. So are Latinos. The drug war is rolling along just fine, particularly at the state level and in Santa Cruz County as well. And throwing people into jail where they have inadequate health care, inadequate isn't the word, where they're dying at the rate of one a week, is there has to be a word slightly short of genocide, but when you're allowing this condition to consciously continue month after month, year after year, and simply engaging in the profiteering of opening more and more prisons, creating more and more crimes, expanding the police bureaucracy, when the crime rate isn't increasing at all, you are engaging in a kind of, it's a sort of a sinister sickness, it's sort of a cancer in the society. And you see it in Santa Cruz downtown. That's why we're protesting ourselves in our own local way. That's why I'm protesting the unnecessary and abusive use of the police and presence of the police against poor people and homeless people. And I invite people to join the protest 2:00 in front of Bunny's Shoes on Saturday. Let's get some more street interviews, and who knows, maybe I'll get back to this pile of papers.
Yeah, not for broadcast. No.
Well, first, another one of them musical breaks.
As I was out riding one morning for pleasure, I spied a young cowboy a-riding along. His hat was thrown back and his spurs were jingling, and as he was riding he was singing this song.
Wilkie-tie-i-yo, get along, little doggies, it's your misfortune, ain't none of my own. Wilkie-tie-i-yo,
and the very next day we go out on the trail. Whoopie-tie-i-yo,
whoopie-tie-i-yo, get along, little dogies.
It's your misfortune, ain't none of my own.
Whoopie-tie-i-yo,
where there's never a town. Our horses are weary, we're tired and we're hungry. Lay still, little doggies, stop roaming around. Whoopie-tie-i-yo,
whoopie-tie-i-yo,
get along,
get along,
little doggie,
little doggie.
It's your misfortune, ain't none of
mine. Whoopie-tie-i-yo, get along.
Straying, they're farther from home than they've been before. Come on, little doggies, it's time to be rolling. When we get to Wyoming, we'll roll no more.
Whoopie-tie-i-yo,
this is for broadcast, and it is about 7:15 on Tuesday evening, July 21st. We're in front of New Leaf Market talking with
Aspen.
And Aspen, you say that, I recall we talked earlier, you were using a different name at that time, but
yes,
you,
Zoran,
and you had, there had been a confrontation up at the Staff of Life. I guess somebody mistook your interaction with someone as a violent one, called the police, and your friend
It wasn't the Staff of Life, it was the food bin. Sorry about that, Staff of Life.
Punched in the face by the police and then arrested for resisting arrest, and has just, I guess, gotten out of jail or out of the farm for the 3-month term or whatever that he served there. You went up to Staff of Life on the mission for what purpose?
No, food bin.
To the food bin. Not Staff of Life, food bin. For what purpose?
Well, I've known the food bin since I've been 6 years old. My father's a doctor, and it's a health food store, and I go there. And with my partner that we were, you know, buying there in the Herbal Room, there was a little confrontation, but it was nothing big. And we were buying, and then the police came in and did that to us.
You're talking about this incident we just talked about?
Yeah, so it was like insult to injury. And then I went in there with the local manager. I believe his name is Demetrius or whatever.
You wanted to apologize, you're saying?
Yeah, well, I wanted to come in and negotiate and say, hey, I love this health food store, and I like to patronize it. But it was like spineless about the police and the injustice there. And then he was just really rude to me, amongst other things, about, you know, me actually being able to patronize the food bin, which I was there before he was even there as management. And it saddens me because that's such a special place for me, and to have that out of my life, I don't enjoy that at all, especially because the police were the only aggressors in this case.
Remember the names of the officers involved?
Yes, I know it was AJ and Klein. AJ doing the punching, and then Klein as well being there. There's like 8 of them for this incident, and they definitely were very militant and federal, and it's just ridiculous how bad it was.
We actually did an interview with Eric, who is the fellow who the police punched and eventually convicted of resisting arrest. Was it resisting arrest or assault on an officer? The point was, as it was described to me, and I was not a witness to this incident, but this is the story as told by the man who's speaking, Aspen or Zoran, and Eric. The Aspen / Zoran is a sort of an enthusiastic fellow who gets carried away sometimes and got into a kind of a euphoric interaction, which was mistaken as a conflict with his friend Eric. And the store called the police. They were outside. The police came over and started giving orders to these guys. And it sort of upset Eric, and he kind of refused to obey an order. And he got the policeman punched him, and he then resisted after being punched. And he was convicted. Well, he actually did he pled to this because the other witnesses were police officers, and his witnesses were either too far away or too apprehensive. And it's a difficult situation. So the issue here became, here's Aspen Zoran coming back months later saying, I'd like to, you know, clarify that I'm not a menace to the food bin staff or customers. I'd like to be able to buy food. And he's being, by his account, treated rudely and essentially excluded.
Yeah.
I thought there were only 3. You say there were 8?
Well, there's like 3 or 4 police cars, maybe. I can't remember because it was a longer time ago, but I know that AJ was the one that was the puncher of Eric.
AJ being, what was the officer's full name, do you know?
I can't remember. No. I'm sure I could look it up. I thought to, but...
But the staff of life fellow, the manager... Staff of life. Although staff of life has problems, too. I understand they are criminalizing people who are going into the Triangle Park across from the... But that's another story. So food bin, I got to get my name straight here. The manager there told you exactly what?
Well, he said because there was a violent issue between my partner and I, which was not, there was not a violent issue there, that I could no longer shop there. And then I was like, well, this is a human rights natural healing store. This is in the 60s. This is standing up for the bohemian and the one that believes in the earth ways and natural ways. And I couldn't believe it was just like he'd bent over and fallen over to this higher authority. And you can clearly say his mannerism was just stuck up, I would say, to the point where it was just insultive to me the way that he was rudely even dealing with me. There's no compassion, no hint of, oh my God, the law is getting way past where it should be at a federal level. It's just outrageous. I see it. It's just outrageous. It's like a police state.
Now, it's interesting that you were going in there. You were actually purchasing something, and
no.
There would have been nothing to advise them of what was going on or remind them, except that you went in and, expressed some contrition or some concern or something? Or had you been told before not to come in?
No, I was purchasing like breakfast, which is pricey there. It was like $10.52, and I was in the middle of that. And then this wonderful little manager, is like a little twin copy of him, came and said, well, he will see you now. And so I went in there with a really good attitude. But
you took the initiative to go see him.
Oh, yeah, I care about the food being like life. I've been
Why
there since...
Why didn't you just simply go ahead and, you know, buy food and then just continue your activities? You weren't flagged down and told you couldn't be there initially, right?
Yeah, well, that's what was happening originally, is that this other lady there, I don't know her name, she's just like a real militant herself as well, was there, and she's just really after me, like I'm done something just horrible, which I don't believe. It's just that attitude there is just kind of so stuck
when
up.
When did she tell you, when did she come out with this attitude?
I had bought some food that night, and I was really pacifying myself. I had a hard day, and I was eating my food, and then she walks in, and it's just so rude. Just a rude attitude, and I'm like, most of the people at the food bin are very cool people.
She told you you couldn't come back, or?
Yeah, she set that up with the management there.
How long before this incident today did that incident happen? Did she tell you that?
It was within days of each other. She really has it out for me.
So you were concerned that perhaps her, you wanted to change that by talking to the manager, and the manager refused, right?
Yeah, I was very polite and cordial to them. I don't wish to be at times because they're so rude. But, yeah, I was very polite and cordial. And I think that they stand for human rights there in the past, I know. And I know that they care about people that are alternative and here in Santa Cruz to stay and live like an alternative life. And it really is difficult for me to believe that management could allow such atrocities on their parking lot at all.
We've been talking with...
I'm Aspen or Zoran, and I go by... Yeah.
Either.
And the atrocities he's talking about are police... punching a citizen in the face, supposedly to protect the two citizens from each other, even though they have no dispute, or perhaps simply because they are not following the military chain of command of the police department, even though the police department really has no business in involving itself if there's no criminal behavior actually happening.
His name's. What do you hear from Eric, your companion who was actually jailed for all this? Is he back on the street?
Yeah, he's back in shape. But, you know, if we had the money, we would have gotten a private lawyer and tried to go after them or whatever. But, yeah, it was a real atrocity that happened. It was just really wrong. I mean, it's just a real brute police force task that has come in, clearly exercises power beyond limits, and then gets away with it. And the only people that made the scene that it was made by was the police.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert.
Aspen.
Thank you, Robert.
Okay, well, this is out right after the Huff meeting about 11:35 on...
And let's take another musical break, and we'll be right back.
Okay, well, this is out right after the Huff meeting.
And we'll make it a short musical break. Back to the street interviews.
Okay, well, this is out right after the Huff meeting about 11:35 on Wednesday, the 22nd of July, 2009. Talking with...
Mark.
And Mark, you said you have some reports from the Red Church?
Sure. Yeah, it appears that they're kind of battening down and kicking people out for loitering. I went over there just to sit down with a friend, and one of the members of the church came out and said, "You guys, we have no loitering here. You have to leave." And I've been told that it's a come-and-go kind of thing. Some days they kick people out, some days they don't. But
what day was this that you were told?
I believe it was Monday.
And Monday, the day of the coffee house?
Yeah, it was early in the day.
And who told you this? Remember the name of the person or what she or he looked like?
He was dressed in the proper garb of a minister, priest.
He was Joel Miller, Pastor Miller?
Pastor, yes. And he was very nice about it, but he was also just enforcing the fact that this, I think the Red Church is the only grassy area where anybody can sit near downtown.
People like you, sir.
Not people.
Get a job. Get a shave. Get shorter.
There you go. There's very selective things going on here. I see people who look nice and they're playing nice music and they're not getting harassed by the cops, but if the grungy homeless kids get around, then all the rules pop out of the woodwork, you know.
Well, what do you expect?
Well, you know, come for
justice?
The dregs.
No, just us.
First they came for the dregs.
Thank you. We've been talking with
Mark.
So we're out here on the sidewalk of the Sub Rosa, having been told it's a no recording policy inside. Although I've got to say that Kai, the manager of the Sub Rosa, one of the collective members, was very polite. She waited until we finished our interview before coming over and asking that we move outside. And with some grumbling and debating, we did. And we're talking with
Michael Moya. I'm from Los Angeles.
And Mike, you biked up to San Francisco through Santa Cruz, back to Santa Cruz. And the first day you got here, you ran into the police.
On a Wednesday last week, the police stopped me for airing my views on the street. I thought I had a right to the freedom of speech.
You were speaking loudly. A controversial issue in Santa Cruz, Proposition 8, you were in favor of it. Many Santa Cruzans are opposed to it. But you were speaking in a voice that was above the ordinary conversational volume, but not to the level of disturbing the peace. And this was acknowledged by the police, right?
Right. They even acknowledged that I was speaking up and not yelling. She said that I didn't hear any yelling. But
where did this happen? Where did these police officers talk to you?
50 feet from the New Leaf.
Okay, and that was about what time of day?
At that time, it was about 4 o'clock.
Yeah, on a Wednesday afternoon.
Wednesday afternoon, yes.
And what were you saying? Give us an example of what you were saying.
Well, I was... I'm a biblical, let's just call it a theologian, okay? And I've studied the Bible for 25 years, and I was speaking about the homosexuality and what the Bible says about it.
Mm-hmm. And so this is not a popular position in Santa Cruz or a politically correct position. In fact, it's a position I'm opposed to, but I'm in favor of your right certainly to espouse that position.
Oh, exactly. That's the thing that is going to hold us together, is if we could speak our minds and oppose without fighting or without calling cops or inflicting punishment on each other, because we have conflicting viewpoints. We probably agree on a lot of other things.
So what happened then?
Well, she asked me to sit down. You know, she wants to take a dominant position over me, and I go, I'm not fighting anything. So I took my seat, and then she's looking at my eyes and sizing me up. Now, mind you, I've been on a bike ride, and I'm kind of on vacation. I did a silly thing, is get a couple of sunburns, okay, and my skin was looking pretty bad. And I have a tooth missing on my side, so I think she's profiling me, and I have very unusual eyes. I've been commented, people have commented on them all my life, okay, and I'm 54 years old. So she looks at these things, and I believe I get profiled. She sees my bike, further profile, a homeless man coming through here, probably indigent. Look at him. He looks horrible. He's unshaven, and...
kind of a relatively trim-looking, I'm not quite, kind of a mustache that extends down to your chin and a bit of a goatee.
Yeah, I decided to start shaving just last New Year's, and I've done it, and I keep very well cleaned up, but I ran out of razors. I didn't have a razor. I thought I was going to buy a razor that day, and I think that's part of the profile. You know, I'm unclean, unkept, obviously a lowlife of some kind, and we don't want a derelict, another derelict on our streets.
Now, did she actually say anything that was specifically addressing those concerns or issues?
No, I made statements towards that.
Now, what was the name of the officer was?
Schoenfield, and she had a helper, a smallish man that was going through my bags.
And you suggest this might be Officer Winston, but you're not sure. You think he had gray hair, though?
Yeah, it was. I think he had gray hair. Maybe I
don't think Officer Winston. I think Winston is younger than that. But as anyway, so you gave the consent to look through your property, which I advised against later when we talked about it.
Yes,
but you felt that was because you were a little bit apprehensive about not you felt you had nothing to hide, perhaps.
Exactly.
Although, you know, with the police, you always have something to hide, because actually it's none of their business, and they can often take innocent kinds of items, as apparently may have happened in your case, and regard them as evidence of a crime.
Yeah, I had a vile assault, and they right away called it crystal meth. No analysis, just looking at it, and I don't take crystal meth. I've never taken crystal meth. I'm not
a crystal meth kind of guy.
No, I'm totally opposed to that kind of stuff, you know.
So and now what, did you tell them it was salt?
Yes, I told them it was salt. They asked, and I told them.
And what was their response?
They went to control substance, and it's crystal meth. And
did they do any tests, or did they taste it, or did they examine it with some kind of procedure that would indicate, you know, give some indication that it wasn't salt, or that it was something else?
I suggested that he taste it, find out that it's salt, and he said something to the effect that I'm not going to taste it. Like as if he's going to get high, or he's going to get buzzed or stoned or ripped or whatever you call it.
So what happened then?
Well, Ms. Schoenfeld, Officer Schoenfeld, looks in my eyes and says my eyes are tripping her out or something like that. And
show me your eyes.
Obviously eyes. On crystal meth.
Wow, you do have very distinct eyes. They're kind of almost glow, and your pupils are somewhat dilated. I mean, they look like they're larger than usual. Or they're very impressive kind of eyes. They're you have beautiful eyes.
Yeah, I know. I won't marry you, but
given your concerns,
I do believe that. I've been told so many times over and over again, and in fact, 5 minutes before the incident, a woman says I have beautiful eyes, and my public defender, she approached me, and the first thing she says is, what beautiful eyes you have, and she said it in a most distinct way, very definite, and that was the first thing she said to me. So I get this action, so it's just one person's opinion, you know, and the person who is suspicious, and I told her, well, why does this woman see that I have beautiful eyes, and you see me that I'm on drugs? And she said, because I know that you're on drugs. I said, no, you are suspicious that I am on drugs. You have no knowledge of me being on drugs. You know, you do not know me. The other woman that I had met and told me I have beautiful eyes, I have now met with her on 3 or 4 occasions on the street. I've been here a week. I think I'm doing pretty good.
What happened then?
Then they copped me, put me in the car, and took me down to the station and interviewed me over there.
What kind of interview did that involve?
Oh, it involved in sitting on a cold stool with a little table there, and I had to pee in a cup. But actually, they didn't talk to me at all. They asked me just basic stuff, who I am. They wanted to know who I am.
How long were you held at the police? Is it the police station or the jail?
I was at the police station for, I would say, an hour.
And then what happened?
And then after that, they took me down the street to the county jail.
And then what happened there?
At the county jail, I had to wait and wait and wait and sign a paper for my the release of my property or acknowledgement of my property or whatever.
And most of your property went to the police station rather than to the jail, right?
Yes, that's right.
And what kind of property was it?
I have a bicycle, okay, and some luggage on my bicycle and a backpack.
And most of that went to the police station?
Yes, and I didn't get everything back.
What happened?
Oh, I had it
released on Thursday, the day after, or Friday, you say, the day after.
I was released on Friday.
So you were held a day in jail?
Yes, a full day and 2 nights.
Did they give you a bail? I guess you were
$5,000 bail.
Uh-huh. And then you went to court.
Yeah, I went to court, and I'm charged with being under the influence and possession of a controlled substance.
Did they present a drug report that indicated that their findings were that there was some illegal drug?
They didn't submit anything. They're not talking. When Officer Schoenfeld asked if I want to talk about the case, I said, okay, come on, let's talk about it. And then they don't say anything. They're playing a game like, don't say anything. I go, I have nothing to hide, absolutely nothing to hide, and I'll play that game. That's the game.
Now, you've got a public defender, right?
Yes.
And what did she tell you?
That I have beautiful eyes.
Oh, for heaven's sake. She didn't want to arrest you for, you know, or share drugs with you.
No.
Now, did she tell you anything about, you have a court date coming up in August, a preliminary hearing?
I have a preliminary hearing on the 14th. She said that I could, if I pled guilty right there, they would assign me 10 class or instruction days or something like this. Just 10.
Drug diversion.
So that's where I'm at. That's what the court is looking. They told me it was a year in prison and up to a year for the other one.
Okay. What was her advice?
I told her I'm not guilty. I never take crystal meth, never have in my life, and that... she didn't give me any advice. She told me to call her up before the court date.
How long did you actually talk to her?
I think less than 2-3 minutes.
And then how long did it take you to get released?
After that, about 2.5 hours.
And that was on Friday?
Friday, yes.
You couldn't get your property back till Tuesday.
Exactly. So I came into Santa Cruz, and I was supposed to, I was going to leave by Wednesday or Thursday morning. But here I've been here all the way around until now Wednesday again.
Because of the narrow window of being able to get property when they were only available at 12:30 to 1 and 4:30 to 5 or some such thing.
Yeah, you know, that's like, how hard could it be to give up property?
That's the police department hours for receiving property. Either it's lost and found or if it's been claimed by the police and it's being released.
Well, you got to walk, in, you know, 100 feet or something or whatever. That seems like a silly thing. Can't there be an officer there or somebody just one of the, whatever, whoever could do that? It seems like a very, very simple procedure. Doesn't seem like the hardest thing in the world to give somebody back.
You came to the Huffman today looking for some support.
And actually, that's another point. You have to walk all the way around the police building, at least if I understand correctly what the procedure is, rather than have a police officer direct you to the property by taking you directly to the property room or bringing out the property in question. You have to circle the police station nearly. Again, all for the inconvenience of the public while more police officers are being assigned to engage in more of these harassment duties downtown to do the kind of stuff that apparently this guy, Mike, was accused of. And I don't know. Who knows? Maybe the so-called salt really was the evil crystal meth. Who knows? It's a bad investment for us. This drug war policy is bad generally. This sounds like an even worse investment. And to be encouraging police further with this kind of stuff really requires us to be much more militant in the community and keep a much closer eye. If you want to join Cop Watch, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, or come to the protest in front of Bunny's Shoes Saturday at 2 o'clock on Pacific Avenue.
Asking for folks to come to your preliminary hearing?
Oh, sure. That's August 14th. Come to my hearing.
What
that
time?
Would be very much appreciated. 9:30.
And, again, your full name is?
Ernest Michael Moya. I've come from a city called Pico Rivera. That's in Los Angeles County, if you know where that is.
You said you intend to hang out here for a month?
No, I intend to go down to L.A. and then take care of business there and then come on back.
Well, be careful you don't bring any salt with you, okay?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
For this interview. Very good.
Thank you for helping. Downtown here, it's about 20 to 3, and we have a genuine ukulele and kazoo and Boy Scout.
It wasn't me. Oh, I swear it wasn't me.
And that's the truth. So we're talking with the infamous Logan Thorne. And Logan, you say that your companion in crime got a sleeping ticket?
Not a sleeping ticket. Lying on the sidewalk while panhandling.
This was a woman, a man, or a person of indeterminate sex?
person who got the ticket was female. The issuing officer was female, and the secondary officer was a female.
So there's a lot of women involved.
Oh, tons of it. Floating a sweet sea of estrogen.
Now, when did this happen?
Three or four days ago.
And where did it happen?
Down in the corner by Borders.
And what was the occasion for the citation?
Well, the occasion for the citation was she was lying down.
Why was she lying down?
Yeah.
Some sort of sexual come on here?
No, I think it was just taking some
exhaustion.
Exhaustion, yes.
Okay. So, and what time of day?
Mid to late afternoon.
Was she warned that there was a criminal violation in progress?
No, she wasn't warned because she was sitting up when I left her.
So what happened? Did you actually see this, or did you just heard about it?
No, I walked up when she was getting the ticket written, and the lovely writing officer didn't seem to care for my presence on the street that night.
And what was the? How do you know that?
She told me not to come back to the avenue again.
Well, why not?
Why not? Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm a troublemaker.
What was your... under pain of what? In other words, if you weren't going to come back... In other words, what would she do if you returned to the avenue?
Just a slight, slight beating, cuff me and stuff me, and take me home, have her way with me.
Did you leave the avenue?
Yeah, it was about dark then. I went to bed, woke up the next morning.
But you succumbed to her wiles, eh?
Oh, yes, yes.
I see. Interesting stuff. So do you have warrants outstanding? Is that the reason you left the avenue?
No, I don't believe I have any warrants outstanding. I've got a couple tickets, but that's everybody does. They just ruin your credit.
Right, although they can, with three unattended infractions, do a misdemeanor. All right, David.
Oh, well.
Anyway, may the afternoon go well for you.
Oh, it should. It should.
Thank you, Logan.
Have a great day.
All right.
What they're doing is all unofficial. It's not written nowhere.
So we have an interesting report from that wise old man of the streets, Mr. Bliss. It's about 10 to 6 on Saturday afternoon in front of Jade next to the Bank of America Instateller. Hello, Jade. Bliss.
Hello.
So you say there's something of interest we should note?
Yes, I think it's more warfare on the poor, class warfare, I guess. And went over to Pick and Pull, looking for parts from motorhome parks, and notice there's no motorhomes there, look over and there's another lot right next to it. It's the DMV impound lot, and it's filled with motorhomes, and so I went over to see what's up with that, and
Pick and Pull is in Moss Landing?
Yeah, Moss Landing, and me and a friend, We started to walk into the yard, and this guy that works there, some Mexican guy that I guess he's like sitting at a desk in there, and he's like, "Hey, where are you going?" "Oh, you can't go in there." I was like, "Well, what's up with all this stuff?" We wanted to look at it, and he goes, "No, you can't look at it. Nothing's for sale. It's all going to be crushed." And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "There's some beautiful motorhomes there, a whole bunch of them, And he goes, "Man, it's all trash." And I'm like, "Well, wait a second, why are you crushing all the motorhomes?" Well, some officer came in and requested us that we do that, and so we're doing it. And I'm like, "Well, you know what?" And so, this officer obviously was the one who told him it's all trash, and he's going along with it. And I told him, in his book, you're trash, and I'm trash too, And so I thought that was pretty appalling that, that they can do that just to... I said, "Why do they want to, crush all these motorhomes?" He goes, "Well, they're tired of dealing with them, and they don't want to have to keep towing them back in again all the time and stuff,
How many of them were there?
How many did you see in that yard? Only three?
That's
wow, when I was there was, closer to 10.
So these were motorhomes that would normally be...
Most of them are older ones, but there was a bunch of them that were nice ones, in the 80s, mid-80s and stuff like that.
It would normally have been sold either for parts or as whole motorhomes?
Or whole motorhomes, yeah.
But the police requested they be destroyed.
Yeah, because they, you know.
According to this guy.
They don't want people, you know, living in motorhomes. Remember how Harvey West Park used to be? All the streets were lined with funky old motorhomes and stuff. Now there's no motorhomes anywhere.
I feel so relieved now that it's
the West Side
so
used to
better.
Be lined up with those things, too, you know, out there by the end of Mission Street.
Yeah, it was junky. Aren't you happy that we have a better town?
They do have that parking lot now, you know.
Parking lot?
On Highway 1, just a quarter mile past Western.
How many motorhomes are there?
Western Drive. Oh, there's over a dozen there every night. Maybe 15 or something.
Can't we find some way to get rid of them?
I don't know. They're trying, I think. And that's one of the ways they're trying to get rid of them. They've gotten rid of most of them. There used to be, like, five times as many in this town, at least, you know. And I think it's working, you know. They've gotten
rid
of
from your old friend Donna Dice, who also lives in a motorhome.
Well, I don't know. We haven't really talked about any kind of stuff like that for a while.
Well, I want a full report. And we've been talking with?
Worry about having a car.
David Bliss.
Thank you, David. Or Bliss, as some have called you.
All right.
I've been told there's an officer downtown who has earned a new reputation, a female police officer.
I'm never down here.
Ah, so that's good. I'm glad to hear that perhaps it's merely apocryphal. Perhaps all is well downtown. Nice hat.
Thank you. I've actually got it really set up.
So I'm up here at the 7, it's a quick stop up here in Felton, about 20 to 3 on July 27th, I guess it is. Right. And I gave a ride to a guy who, what's your name?
My name's Gabriel.
And Gabriel, you're a man who, you got an apartment, but you have to come all the way up to Felton to look for work because in Santa Cruz you don't seem to be able to find it, right?
Yeah, that's very correct. And even I don't have steady work, really. I come around from gas station and try to wash people's windows. The only reason I come up to the San Lorenzo Valley to do it is because I'm not hassled by the owners of the other gas stations in downtown Santa Cruz.
Now, you're not homeless now, but you have been.
Well, very recently I was homeless, probably less than 4 months ago. And it is very difficult, especially making this transition into a new lifestyle.
Tell me about, you mentioned a couple of things as we rode. You mentioned, but your physical safety can be in danger. You also can feel humiliated by police behavior, by stereotyping you. Tell me a little bit more about both those things if you feel like it.
Well, I mean, when you're carrying a lot of luggage and your clothes aren't all clean and you're not a quote-unquote functioning person of this society, then it's really a big stereotype when most of us are really trying hard to make it.
So how are the police treating you? Give me an example of an encounter you've had that you think is typical.
Well, I mean, even since I've transferred over to not being homeless and really, really trying to keep up my appearance. I mean, I had an encounter with someone I knew that was homeless, and we had an argument. And because the local police knew that I used to be homeless, they still didn't treat me any different. They incriminated me when I stated the situation. And I ended up being searched and I was treated very badly. I was being insulted and this is all by the police.
Also said that it becomes difficult for your family because you're how old are you now?
I'm 19 now.
And you had to leave a place you'd been before, your home, your family's home, because they were having problems, right?
Well, my dad's been out of work for now probably 5 months, and it doesn't look like he's going to be receiving his unemployment check that for much longer. I was asked to leave because I just simply, my parents can't support my living situation. They can't support, like, I also have a little brother and sister too they have to take care of. So I was asked to leave.
Now, were you Were you working? Were you able to find work when you had lodging with your folks? Or that was about a year and a half ago, more or less. Or was it difficult then?
Well, it was still difficult, but I mean, it was in reach. I mean, right now the economy is just a pile of, pardon my language, but
shit.
I mean, yeah. Well, it's like right now work is just it's just pretty much people feeling sorry for each other and giving them a little bit of side work, even if they don't have the money to afford to hire anyone.
You said that you also did a lot of couch surfing, but then essentially you kind of burned out your friends because that's not unusual. It happens to a lot of people who do that. Tell me how that went.
Well, I mean, it's like everyone's out of work. It's a nationwide thing. So I was just not being considerate, and I always needed a place to stay. I didn't have steady work, so I never really had food, and I ended up burning my bridges by just making, just over-welcoming myself.
And when you became homeless, how did you deal with that after the couch surfing ran out? Did you stay outside? Did you stay in vehicles? What'd you do?
I pretty much stayed wherever I could. I mean, unlocked cars, unlocked houses. Essentially I stayed pretty much in a sleeping bag in the bushes. So it's like, you never know what's going to happen when you're, it's hard to fall asleep the first few nights you go completely homeless.
Now, you also mentioned some close shaves or some actual assaults that you've suffered.
I've been assaulted, several times by other homeless people, and during the rainy season, I mean, everyone's always trying to get inside, and I've had some real questionable older men invite me over for the night,
demanding sexual favors.
Yeah, which forced me to leave, losing most of my stuff in their houses, and just leaving on an urgent. Stuck in the rain.
How many times has this happened to you?
Twice. But I mean, God knows how many more people this is happening to, especially women. I mean, this is some stuff that really needs to be looked at and really needs to be taken care of.
Any kind of a network of support for you among homeless people while you were out there? Was there any solidarity? Was there more solidarity or less solidarity? What was the feeling among other people you knew?
Well, I have to say that there were some people I could trust, but the number one rule really is, and I mean, I'm not bluffing at all, the number one rule really is, don't trust anyone. And it's hard to live by that rule when you've grown up with a solid family your whole life.
And have you been back to your family for... Are they advised of any of this, or are you keeping a distance from them?
I still keep in contact with my family. The only thing is, it's just they know that I can't live at home because there's not enough food, there's not enough room, and it's sad, but it's something that has to happen. My dad, my father, because his father was in the Depression, and my father was asked to leave at an early age, too.
So what kind of work did your father do before he was laid off?
My dad's a Union 377 iron worker.
Wow. Is there any career that you'd like to pursue if you had the means and the opportunity?
If I had the opportunity, I really want to start going to Cabrillo. And I have a high school diploma, and it would just be nice if somehow I had the funds to go to Cabrillo and maybe a UC someday.
But that wouldn't necessarily make you money. Is there is there anything you're thinking of about the next few years that would A, give you money, but also B, something that you would either at least be able to tolerate and maybe even enjoy?
Oh yeah, well, pretty much anything. I mean, I got good people skills, so I'd like to work at a gas station or maybe a convenience store or just anything that I could get my hands on, really. I mean, like, I've been doing yard work and stuff, too, for people. And just, I don't know, for steady work, I'd like to manage a store someday, like my own liquor store, convenience store.
Now, you've mentioned at different gas stations you've been offering to wash windows, which is what homeless folks often do in the big cities. How much do you usually make per gas station doing that, and how long does it take you?
Well, it all depends on, like, the traffic and rush hour and stuff like that, but most of the time I make $5 to $10 every gas station, and that's for usually an hour and a half, 2 hours worth of work. And it all depends on who wants their windows washed, and really I only ask a quarter, so but most of the time I end up with 50 cents. But a lot of times, like, as I had a problem in downtown Santa Cruz, I was having the gas station manager kick me out.
And does that happen frequently, occasionally, or rarely?
Frequently.
And is it because, well, how would you describe your dress? How would you say you're dressed? I mean, you look casually dressed. You got, it's hard, you got a baseball cap, or whatever it is. Looks like a baseball cap.
Yeah.
A big shirt goes down to your, about to your knees. Tennis shoes? What are they?
Yeah, tennis, skateboarding shoes.
Yeah. Would it be accurate to describe you as a skater kid?
I guess that would be it. But actually, when I go to wash windows, I take off my overshirt, and I don't get anything on it. And
it's very clean.
I usually don't wear my baseball cap because it gets hot out when I'm moving around and trying to get wash windows and dry off the side of the car and everything like that.
Now, you found lodging again, you said, but you also said that it had some consequences because you had to kind of conceal from your housemates and landlord the fact that you had been homeless or that you have homeless friends.
Yeah, well, I mean, like I said before, homelessness is a stereotype. When someone sees someone that's homeless, they think they're part of a different tribe, almost. They think that they're not one of them. They really sincerely think that they're an overall better person and better human being than this person who's homeless.
Sounds like you need a new approach. I'm homeless, kick me for a dollar.
Yeah, it doesn't usually, I don't know. It's like people aren't bashing on the homeless so much, but it's a stereotype that all homeless people are either alcoholics or drug users, and it's like people just don't want to associate with those kind of people.
You did mention that a number of your friends have drug problems, which may result in a difficulty for you. How are you doing yourself? Do you feel you have a drug problem or not?
Well, currently I do not have a drug problem.
At one time you did?
Yes, I did.
How did you deal with it?
Not very well, I must say. I didn't use drugs, except for
meth, heroin, cocaine. Are we talking or grass?
Well, I used grass before I went homeless, but when I went homeless, I was exposed to a lot more other drugs like heroin and cocaine and crystal meth, and the list goes on.
And did you find yourself spending a lot of money and time with those drugs, or just occasionally?
Well, that was, like I said, the number one rule is you can't trust everyone, but that needle's always going to be there for you when you need him.
So, is that still a problem for you?
It's not still a problem, but it's definitely haunting my mind still to this day.
And you also mentioned that this becomes a complication for you when you're looking for cheaper lodging at the moment, and you hitchhike up to Felton frequently, or
Yes, every day.
And you generally are able to make some money up here.
Yeah. I do pretty good up here, actually. And I feel like I'm working for what I earn. And it's worth it to me to lodge up here.
But you don't earn enough to make $700 a month to pay the rent.
Well, currently, no. I mean, it took me a while of saving up. I was homeless while I was saving up this money, too, to get this rent. And I paid the deposit and the rent for this month. And I'm on the tail end of the majority of the rent for this next month. So we'll see what happens.
Are you able to eat regularly, or do you use a lot of the homeless services, like the meals and so forth?
I use the homeless services, the soup kitchen at St. Francis, the 115 Coral Street. They feed in the morning every day, and in the afternoon at 4.
How does that go? How's the food?
It's really not that bad when your choices are eat a full meal or go home and eat an instant soup.
And how's the company?
It's challenging because, I mean, I'm trying not to associate with other people that use drugs and stuff. And I'm trying not to associate with, I don't know, it's really, really difficult transitioning from not being homeless. From being homeless to not being homeless.
You've also mentioned that, you know, do you find you share some...
Well, you can hear the rest of this interview, I'm sure, on Sunday when Robert Norris returns. I have been nice enough to allow Robert to let that interview play out a few more minutes into my show. That's because I'm a totally nice guy and underappreciated and certainly underpaid. Anyway, I am Uncle Dennis. This is a show called From the Cream to the Dregs. And we will be playing music up until about 9 o'clock when we'll air the Earth First Update. And then at 10 o'clock, 9:30, more music. At 10 o'clock, our Spotlight Group of the Week, a whole hour of one artist or group for your listening, enjoyment, and edification. And whatever else you think you may get out of it, you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're at 101.1 FM and also out on the wide, weird web at freakradio.org. Here's some Eric Clapton for you.
Bye.